New World Witchery is a Patreon-supported podcast. This episode is supported by listener Sherry. We greatly appreciate your longtime support for us, and so we're going to name you our official Sweet Tea Leaf Reader for the show. We look forward to hearing all of your best predictions read in an icy glass of honey-sweet summer goodness. Thanks to Sherry for your support of this episode and for your ongoing support of New World Witchery. If you'd like to become a patron and help support the show while also getting some great perks, please visit www.patreon.com/newworldwitchery, where you can pledge a dollar a month or whatever you can afford to help keep our Lipton teabag supply fully stocked. And thanks to all of our listeners.
Are you looking for magic? Maybe magic that lives right where you do?
If so, join us aboard our broomsticks and ride with us from the Atlantic to the Pacific, from the Yukon to the Yucatan, and find magic that's right outside your front door or just off of Route 66.
Whether you're in the Windy City or the Crescent City, the city that never sleeps, or the city of brotherly love, we've got enchantment for you.
I'm Corey.
And I'm Lane, and this is New World Witchery.
This time around, we're flying into the Appalachian Mountains and landing at the kitchen table of Byron Ballard. For those who grew up in the South, it was borderline impossible to escape the sounds of country music. Now, that music isn't everyone's taste, of course, and I'm not a fan of a lot of what plays on mainstream country radio myself, but there are still a few singers and styles I always pause and let the radio play on if I'm searching for stations. If you're anywhere near Nashville, by the way, check out AM Station 650, which plays the live Grand Ole Opry concerts and a whole wagon load of roots music and older style country, should you be into that sort of thing. Bluegrass has a special place in my heart, as do songs by performers like Johnny Cash and Emmylou Harris and Lucinda Williams and Amanda Shires. Again, not everyone likes country music, but one thing I have found that is pretty much universal is that everyone seems to like at least one country musician, Dolly. Dolly Parton's been a mainstay of the country airwaves for decades, and she's also been a social activist working hard to make the world a little better by supporting childhood literacy programs, providing outreach to people experiencing poverty, and even supporting LGBTQ causes and standing up for members of the community. She famously has advocated for her theme park in the Smoky Mountains, Dollywood, to be family-friendly and specifically making sure that family includes all of her LGBTQ family as well. Dolly has become such an icon that people even have Novena candles with her image on them to invoke her spirit of support, compassion, and acceptance. So, why am I talking about Dolly Parton on a show about witchcraft? Well, yes, there are the Novena candles, but more specifically, I want to mention one of my favorite songs of hers called These Old Bones from her 2002 album Halos and Horns. That song, like so many of Dolly's songs, tells a story. In it, a young woman goes to visit an old fortune teller woman up in the mountains, who uses a bag of bones to divine the fates of the locals. The lyrics read, "In a little pouch of burlap, tied with a piece of twine, there were bones all shapes and sizes, gathered through the course of time. She'd throw them out before you, she swore that she could see, the present, past, and future, she could read your destiny." The girl is a little scared at first, but comes to discover she's got her own gift of seeing, and that the old woman has a special connection to her. And, of course, that the bones aren't really what give her the power to know things. That kind of knowing, that wise woman stock figure, is very much the embodiment of our guest this time around on New World Witchery. We're speaking to H. Byron Ballard, the author of numerous books on Appalachian folk magic and other magical practices and traditions, including Staubs and Ditchwater, Roots, Branches and Stones, and Seasons of a Magical Life. She's been at her work for a long time, having even earned the moniker Asheville's Village Witch from the local newspaper. Like Dolly, Byron extends compassion to her community and works both within her magical fold and her neighborhood, family, and friends to add a little enchantment to the world. She's also spent a good bit of her online writing discussing the era of Tower Time, an epithet for the age of constant upheaval we've experienced in the past decade or so, and trying to offer ways to focus inward, to work locally, and to pursue magic earnestly so that all witches can be ready for the era to come. Getting to speak with her was a little bit like visiting the woman in the Dolly Parton song, and the conversation was an absolute delight. We hope that you enjoy it. So pull up a seat at Byron's table, and let's sit down for some tea, empathy, and magic. All right, we are joined this time by Byron Ballard, who is the author of several books on, we'll say witchcraft, but really they range quite all over the place. They wander over quite a few hills, which is appropriate because Byron is also known as the Village Witch of Asheville, North Carolina, and has a practice rooted in the mountains around her, as well as the sort of the practice found more broadly kind of in Southern traditional folk magic. So Byron, thank you so much for joining us here on New World Witchery.
Oh, it is my pleasure to be here.
We are thrilled to have you. It is shocking it's taken us this long to get you. That is entirely my fault because we've been in contact for, I think, 5 years trying to work this out.
Yeah, and we almost met. I was coming up to the Kutztown Festival 4 years ago, maybe. Uh-huh.
Something like that, yeah.
We were all ready, and then, I don't know, something happened down here. Something blew up, and I had to stay home.
Yep. Yeah, and we have some mutual friends who, you know, they it's always this sort of like, why aren't you two ever in the room together? Maybe we should convince them we're the same person. That's what we should do.
Because they never have seen us in the same place at the same time.
Exactly. It's like Superman and Clark Kent, right?
All right. Well, we both wear glasses, so I don't know who's going to be Clark Kent.
You look a lot better in lipstick than I do. I'll be honest about that. Fair enough. Well, okay. Let's start with this whole, the Village Witch of Asheville, right? This is kind of the epithet that you're known as. And it's not something that's, you know, recent, right? You had this for a long time.
Yeah.
Talk us through that. How did you get to that title? What does that title mean to you?
Okay. I'm happy to go back into the far distant past. When I travel now, people will say to me, oh, you are so lucky to live in Asheville, North Carolina, because you have such a vibrant pagan community and there's some blah, blah, blah. And I explained to them that we didn't have that. That the reason we have that is because we built it over the course of 30 years. We built it brick by brick. And before we did that, we made the bricks. So anybody can have a vibrant pagan community. They just have to be willing to put in the work. Because right now, Asheville, North Carolina feels like this lovely, in fact, it is called the Sedona of the East. Mm-hmm. It's this kind of new age, artsy capital. We're Beer City, USA, but that wasn't true 30, 35 years ago. It was not at all true. So to do the work that I and many other people did to create this community took a lot of guts. We all took a lot of hits. We took hits in local media. And of course, this was before social media. God knows what it would have been like then. And we, you know, if you were in the paper, then the death threats would come. Now, they didn't come through your email necessarily, but you get letters from people, anonymous letters saying, you are a child of Satan, and quoting Leviticus, thou shalt not suffer a witch to live. Mm. So to claim that word, in one way, to claim it publicly was tricky, but my family have always used that word, and that's unusual. In my research, I have found that people who practice this kind of folk magic, who are Methodists, will sometimes use the word witch. Baptists never use it. So my family were lapsed Methodists, and so I am, in fact, an unchurched child of almost unchurched Methodist parents. Mm-hmm. And because we always use that word, we used it with my grandmother and they used it with my great-grandmother. I knew from an early age that's what I was and that's what I was doing. So that if you look at my high school yearbook, a friend of mine had written in the margin somewhere to my friend, the communist witch, who's the head of the mafia. So I've been known by that for so long that it's a hat that feels comfortable to wear. Mm-hmm. But to brand my business, Asheville's Village Witch, mm-hmm. it was surprisingly, people were surprisingly contemptuous about that. So people who didn't believe in witchcraft and thought I was being ridiculous kind of looked down their noses. And people who thought that was dangerous got out their crosses and pitchforks. And then I started hearing from, and it was, I say that like it was a lot of people, but I heard from three different people around the world who referred to themselves as a village witch. Mm-hmm. And they demanded to know what my credentials were. So how come you call yourself that? Is that just some crazy Western thing? Is that something that, how do you do that? And what do you do that makes you a village witch? And I was able to say that what I do that makes me the village witch is that I bless babies, I bless the dying, I sit with the dying, I do hand fastings and weddings. I'll come and do energy clearing in your house. I'll bring you chicken soup. I do all those things that village witches have traditionally done for millennia, probably. So that's how I came to be the village witch. And the sidebar of that is that right before I got on here with you, I've got a print order that I'm getting some quotes on. So I called a print company here in town and I was trying to explain. It was a deck of cards and I was trying to explain it. She said, "Oh no, I have tarot cards and I know who you are. You're the village witch." Mm-hmm. And I just laughed and said, "Yes, I am the village witch." And she said, "Oh, we would love to do this order for you." So most people know that's what I am, but that is not nearly so popular as it once was here. Mm-hmm. So I can do my work without too many death threats these days.
Right. And I mean, and you know, when you say that, you know, you've been doing this, that people knew kind of who you were, knew that title. It's important to also note, like you were putting kind of a regular article in the local newspaper. It's essentially an advice column or sort of a perspectives column. Right. And so people, you know, you've been in the public eye for a very long time with this.
Oh yeah. For a very long time. The local Gannett paper contacted me when they first got their website, and they were trying to find people in the community who were interesting, who would drive traffic to their website. And they contacted me and they asked me if I would do a blog mm-hmm. about which witch was which, because there are, you know, there are a lot of witches in the area. And I was very happy to do that. And I blogged for them for several years. I blogged almost every day with different things that were happening in the community or events and all kinds of stuff, practice, all that. Yeah, I've been writing about this for a long, long time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I mean, and I also really love the sort of emphasis you're putting on, like, you know, people are asking for your credentials, that community becomes such a central part of this, because we're so used to, and I don't think there's anything wrong with people who need to practice in a solitary way, practicing in a solitary way, obviously, but
no, nor do I.
But the community aspect of this is also important, and it's worth emphasizing that that's a huge part of what you have done and what sort of exists around you because of your involvement. So, I mean, if you think about kind of the witchcraft community and the aspect of being a witch in service to community, what does that mean to you?
Well, it's the work, isn't it? And I am always wagging my finger at people in social media saying, maybe I should quit arguing tiny points of protocol and do some damn work. Mm-hmm. I think we get called to do the work that is our heart's work. And you can certainly not take the call, but if you take the call, it puts you on a path of service. And there is something beautiful about that. You know, when I say it like that, oh, it puts you on a path of service. That sounds very servant leadership and very sort of soft around the edges. But what it means in real terms is that you may be down by the river at midnight with two or three people who are trying to remove a long-standing family curse. And then the next day, you may be up at 10 o'clock to do an interview with a local paper. Mm-hmm. And by one, you may be doing a baby blessing in another county. So it's a busy life that for the most part doesn't pay. Mm-hmm. We don't do it so much now with COVID, but I used to do a lot of interfaith work, which I think is really, really important for our people. And in the interfaith work, I would have clergy people say to me, oh, well, but I can't do that. I'm too busy. And I'd say to them, look, I'm sure you are busy, but there's nobody sitting around this table that's busier than I am. And y'all have a Roth IRA and you have a retirement plan and you get paid every other week. So don't be pulling that out as your excuse for I can't get that done, because mm-hmm. other people are working as hard or harder than you. And what they are getting from that is the peace and the joy that comes with service, but they also get the pain in the butt that comes with service.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, service is not it's not just blessing the babies, like you said. It's it's down and dirty work sometimes, and sometimes you're dealing with stuff that's terrifying or heartbreaking. So yeah. I'm sure there's a lot of sort of death stewardship that kind of comes into this too, for example, and that's hard.
It is, but it's also glorious. That's one of the best things. And I don't want to sound tacky about that, but in the South in general, and up in the mountains in particular, we do death pretty well. We're not afraid of it. So that sitting with the dying is something that's expected culturally, mm-hmm. that there's going to be somebody in the family that does that. And sometimes there's nobody in the family left. We live in such a transitory culture now that that my elderly neighbor, who may have three children, those children may live in Atlanta and Los Angeles and Charlotte, so they can't be here. So there's also that piece of the death stuff, but I don't want it to sound like it's some kind of scary and noble thing that we do here, mm-hmm. because we love a good death. And we love to celebrate a long life or a short life. And we know exactly what to do if somebody dies. Is it you start frying chicken? Mm-hmm. You make a banana pudding? You make that great. I've been talking about this cake a lot. I think I'm going to have to make it. It's a spice cake with a boiled frosting. It's just the best thing in the world. So we know what to do. And then you go over to the house. And I write about this in a couple of my books. That the object of coming to the house and taking food, because nobody needs food at this point, and it'll be one more bucket of chicken, it'll be one more vat of potato salad. Mm-hmm. But the point is that someone in the family or in that community is going to hold the story of the death, and their job is to transmit that, and your job is to listen to that. And so what happens is you bring your offering. Here I come with my fried chicken. Here I come with my spice cake. And I put that in the kitchen. I get myself a drink. I maybe make myself a plate of food. And then I go find the person who has the story of the death. And I listen to that. And there is a sense in the more modern parts of the culture. Oh, no, I don't want you to have to go through that again. Oh, no, that is that person's job. They are there to carry on the folkloric aspects of what death is in our culture and families. Hmm. And so you don't have to cry. You don't have to do anything else. You just have to sit there and eat your damn overcooked green beans and chew on some chicken and listen to the last 3 days or 4 days or 24 hours and what happened. Hmm. And it's a beautiful thing.
I love that. It reminds me, I mean, growing up in the South, it reminds me certainly of a lot of experiences I have where you know, it's a combination of weeping and wailing and hooting and hollering, right? Like it's this joyous celebration at times. There's, you know, sometimes you'll have awake, right? Which, you know, people are essentially drinking and turning it into a party. And then you go to the funeral the next day and everybody's bawling their eyes out. But it's all, like you said, it's all about kind of that collective mourning and working together to get through that. And I love your point about listening. I think that's such a crucial thing. And it's sometimes really hard for people to understand what that is and how that works. And I think that's true for witchcraft too. I think we find some of the, you know, one of the things I tell people is if you're looking for witchcraft practices, one of the first things that you need to do is find people who have been around for a while and just sit down and listen to what they have to say. They may not talk about witchcraft right away. They may not talk about it very much at all, but they're going to do it. You know, if you just listen.
Exactly. Yeah. People will contact me and they are members of what I refer to as the Appalachian diaspora. Mm-hmm. So they didn't grow up in Appalachia, but maybe their parents did, but certainly their grandparents did. And they'll go, well, how am I supposed to know if my ancestor was a granny witch? And I'll say, first off, don't use that phrase. Mm-hmm. Because that's a phrase that was invented by somebody. This is a practice with no name, as they are in every culture. This set of abilities and workings, they didn't have names for centuries. You just knew who knew what to do, and that's who you went to. So I like to tell people, if you want to know about strands of practice in your family, then you go to some of your older family members and you don't say, so was great-grandma a witch? You say, what are some of those funny superstition things a family used to do? Mm-hmm. And then they will open up and they'll talk about red threads and pieces of colored glass in the window and all this stuff that when we look at it with a modern lens, we go, well, I mean, obviously that's folk magic. That's witchcraft. But these people didn't think of it as witchcraft. I'm very clear when I'm teaching and when I'm writing that the kind of folk magic that I practice, and you know as well as I do, that folk magic practice usually comes down through families. So it could be different from one cove to the next cove, from one county to the next county. But what I practice comes out through an absolute Protestant Christian filter. And yes, you can filter out some of that stuff. Like I don't use the Bible for prognostication and I don't use the Bible for much of anything really, but a lot of people do. So if it has that Christian filter or that Christian lens, then most people who still practice it, and they are legion, the people who still do this practice, they just haven't hung out a shingle. And they don't have a page on Facebook that says, hey, guess what? I practice Appalachian granny magic. They just do it because their mama did it or their grandma did it or their great aunt did it or their daddy did it. Mm-hmm.
Right. Yeah. And the labels, if they put labels on it at all, are going to be different. And everybody practices a little differently, like you said. So, and it's also, you know, it's something where, one of the best things to do is listen, like you said, you can ask them, what were some of those funny superstitions, but also like listen to the stories about, you know, what did they do in times of crisis and struggle? Because I find witchcraft tends to, or magic tends to surface most strongly around those moments of intensity. Death is like what we're talking about with death, or you know, even weddings though, the sort of counterpoint to that, right? That's when you'll find out, oh, what did you have in your shoe at your wedding, right? Oh, well, it was this particular flower, or it was this little coin that I had, right? And that's the stuff where you really see, and you need that context. You need all of the story to make the magic itself make sense and work. So I love that you do that. And that gets me to something about your books that I really love, which is when I read your books, particularly some of your most recent books, there's this style that it is like getting a letter from home. It is so comfortable, not in a sort of like, because you definitely raise some issues that are uncomfortable too. But it feels like a letter I would get from someone I know. It feels very intimate, very personal. I'm curious about your process for writing about witchcraft. Then, like, how do you get to that style? How do you get to that place when you're writing about it?
I've thought about that a lot because I get asked that question. And I don't know if it's because the bulk of my earlier writing was as a playwright. Mm-hmm. So I really want to make a deep connection immediately. But I think it's just the way I write. And for people who follow me on Facebook or anywhere in social media, my social media is kind of the same way. I think it's the style of writing that I do. I sometimes try to do a much more formal style, an academic style, because I'm a member of the Appalachian Studies Association conference. And I present a paper at most of the conferences every year. And I try to make that in more academic speak. But I find that for most people, what they really want to feel like is that they are sitting at my table and I've given them a cup of something to drink. And I've given them something maybe warm from the oven, like a biscuit or a scone from the oven. And we are just talking about stuff. In fact, one of the complaints I've had about the audio book for Roots, Branches, and Spirits that came out in February is the woman who reads it, her accent's okay, but she doesn't have your rhythm. The rhythm of talking to you, the rhythm of your books. She didn't catch the rhythm of that. Mm-hmm. So I've got proposals on their way in for two new books. And I think in the contract, I'm going to specify that I need to read the books. I need to read the audiobook. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, there's something about like that sound. And I mean, we get this here in your conversation with you, which is delightful. And I think people probably expect that from, you know, the workshops that you've done too. But yeah, there's a sound to that. And again, I feel like I pick that rhythm up, and maybe it's because I'm from the South and I know people who write and talk like this, but there's a feel to that. And I really appreciate that.
Well, and it's that natural storytelling that we are rightly famous for, because we can take the simplest event and turn it into a saga. And most people are pretty happy to hear the saga, unless they've already heard it 10 times.
Well, even in that case, I find some people are, you know, listening for what changed this time, right? What's a little different this time? You know, is the trip 50 miles this time, or is it 150 miles? Right?
So, how big is that fish this time?
Exactly. Oh, goodness.
And where are you from originally in the South?
So I'm from the Middle Tennessee area. Not quite Nashville, but sort of rural Middle Tennessee. Grew up on kind of a small gentleman farm, as we would have called it. So,
yeah. Oh, that's sweet. Yeah. Are your folks still there?
No, they passed away when I was younger, so I didn't. Oh, yeah, it was. No, it's the way things work. So, but it was, you know, it is. It's a beautiful thing, and we're going to get onto this whole tangent of talking about our histories here. But yeah, no, there is something about, I think, and not to exclude anybody, but there is something about if you grow up in the South, you get used to these rhythms of speech and this feel for the way that language is used. And every place has that. It's just that I think when two Southern people start talking, we start hearing that pattern, and we're like, yep, that is the rhythm that rocks me to sleep in my head. So.
That's what country music is based on, isn't it?
Well, you'd hope. I've heard some songs that definitely are not. But,
oh, I know. God.
Oh, my goodness. All right. So we talked a little bit about your books. I do want to talk a little bit about your most recent book, which it's a bit of a moving target, because I say your most recent book, you mentioned publishing one in February. You also just had one that came out in August.
Yes, I did the crazy thing of two books from two different publishers in the same year. So, and both crazy publishers have said, we're not doing that again.
Is there any reason why?
Well, they're afraid always that one book is going to hurt the sales of the other book. Mm. That's basically what it is.
Yeah.
But they were far enough apart, and they are different enough in subject and texture that I think they've been fine. I mean, I got a big fat royalty check recently, and it seems like it's selling pretty good.
Yeah. That's a good thing. It's a good thing for sure. So in the book that I'm kind of thinking about here, which is Seasons of a Magical Life, which I you know, kind of bringing this up because I'm thinking this episode's going to wind up being our first in the new year. So people will be thinking about calendars and, you know, seasonal cycles. And you sort of get into this idea of seasonality connected to sort of bioregional practice. And I'd be curious to know kind of what has been your process to discovering or interacting with your own sort of bioregion, and how does your wheel sort of take shape for you?
The languaging around that makes me laugh.
I know this is a very kind of jargony feel to that. But.
Well, I mean, and that's the world we live in right now. Mm-hmm. The only way I can answer that question, I guess, is a phrase I used to use years ago that I've got gnarly roots in this area. Mm. And I'm not from here, and I am not of here. I am here. So my roots, and I can look out, stand in my front yard and just almost see the place in this same neighborhood that my family moved into in the late 1800s from the county next door. I can almost see the place that I went to elementary school. There's too many mountains between me and the middle and high school, but yeah. So my family has been here for a long, long time, and I don't know at this point how I separate myself from the place. I mean, I've lived in different places for a certain amount of time, but I always get back here. I always come back here. And my daughter got a good paying job in Charlotte, North Carolina, the big old city. And she stayed there for 6 years. And she kept saying, I'm not moving back to Asheville. I hate Asheville. She didn't move back to Asheville. This year, she moved back up into the high country beyond Boone. Mm-hmm. So there's something about this place and our roots that has stuck. And mostly that's good, because when I tell people that my daughter is the fifth generation of my family to live in this neighborhood, they are astounded by that, because it's incredibly unusual. But to me, that is just what the family history is. And when people will say about a neighboring county, well, you know how those people in whatever county are, I'll go, yes, I do, because my mama's daddy's people are from that county. So it is a truism that in this area, some people have stayed pretty close to the home place, whether they wanted to or not. Now, what's happening now, of course, is a massive gentrification. Everybody, thanks to the tourism authority, wants to live in Asheville. And they've jacked the prices up so high that a lot of people who have been here for many generations can no longer afford to live here. So they are moving west, and they're moving out. And that is really the underlying story of this region, is of people always moving on. So I feel lucky that I didn't have to move on, except sometimes it just makes me mad. I'd like to move on.
But at the same time, like you said, those gnarly roots, you know, and the service.
Yeah, I could.
Yeah. Yeah. And that sense of like needing to be there for the community as well. I think that's important. So another concept, you know, you talking about kind of, you know, comfort, discomfort, things like that, this, you know, being rooted in a place and feeling comfortable, but there's also discomfort. And we've talked a little bit about kind of the unpleasant sides of some of this, but one concept that you sort of introduced and talked about a lot, and I've seen this particularly in your sort of media presence, is the concept of tower time. And I'd love for you to kind of get into, you know, what do you mean by tower time? And, you know, and the other side of this is, witches, I think, really get hooked into this concept. It's almost as though apocalypses and cataclysms are a breeding zone for witchcraft in some ways. I don't know, maybe you see that differently, but I'm curious, kind of, how do you take, what's your take on Tower Time and this whole cataclysmic apocalyptic
side of witchcraft? I'm sorry, I am laughing because now we get into the esoteric portion of our program where I start to sound vaguely lunatic. So I have been for more than two decades, I have been visited by, as we would say in the mountains, I've been visited by prophecy. And that prophecy is that we are living in the times that where anything that is based on a hierarchical model, anything that is top-down organized, is collapsing. And it's collapsing and then recalibrating and then collapsing a little bit more. So I've been reading cards for 50 plus years. I started reading when I was 12, and y'all can do the math. And the image came to me finally that it is like living in the tower card, the falling tower. And there are lots of places you can be in that card if you're looking at the traditional Smith Rider-Waite card. You can be one of the people falling off the tower. You can be somebody still in the tower shrieking. You can be one of these people running away on the bottom, or you can be the people that aren't on the card anymore because they got out and now they're building the new world that we need to build. The issue for us as humans is that we've been living under 6,000 years of these systems, and we've been living under them because they're incredibly efficient and they're easy to organize. They don't serve anybody. Except they don't even serve the people on the top of the pyramid. The people who are ostensibly the ones in power are not served by the system either, but it's easy. So that we've had several opportunities in throughout culture to stop this, but we don't. We go, oh, well, that fellow that's the president / king / emperor / war leader, well, he's just awful. But as soon as we get this good guy over here in there, then it's all going to be okay. It's not okay because the structure is what's wrong. So I wrote a book in 2018. So when people now go, what the heck is going on? Everything is falling apart. I go, well, and the other piece is, who could have predicted it? I predicted it. In 2018, I wrote a book called Earthworks, Ceremonies in Tower Time. And the first half of it are essays that I've been writing for years and years and years about these premonitions and visions. And the last half is all ceremonies and rituals and ways to ritualize what we're doing. My thing about it is, I don't think it is apocalyptic. I think it is our opportunity to make the world an egalitarian world that works for more people. And more importantly, that serves the environment better. Serves the planet better. So I encourage people to do things like pick three things that are going to be your focus. Because right now, everything is falling apart. It really is. And if you try to fix everything that's falling apart, you will burn out and nothing will get done. But if you pick three things that every time a news article about that comes across your news feed, your gut grips up and you say, this will not stand. I will not allow this to happen. Then you pick those three and you have to go on blind trust that somebody else picked all the other things you're not doing because they did. Because if you choose, for instance, water in your area, knowing where the water system, where it goes, where it comes from, you can make friends with the water authority and know parts per million in the water. You can be an expert on one thing. You can be an expert on three things. You can't be an expert on 100 things. Mm-hmm. So I encourage people to do that. But Tower Time, people say all to them, so when is this going to be over? Like it's a Mercury retrograde cycle. And I go, there's no telling when it's going to be over because we're just now in the beginning throes of it. Mm-hmm. And that's what all of this that we see around us is about. It's about cultural transformation. And yes, sometimes transformation begins with collapse. But it also has an end goal of making things better and not making things worse. There, I'll get off my soapbox.
No, it's a good soapbox. And you kind of predicted sort of what the next question I have, which is this idea of, well, is there a star time kind of coming at some point? The sense of like, and I feel like, you know, one of the things that you sort of tap into here is this idea of, you know, that the tower comes right after, yeah, I think the devil, right? So there's this sense of we were tempted and maybe went a little hog wild for a few centuries for a few reasons, right? And then the tower is kind of that coming home to roost. But for me, at least, when I kind of think about tower time, it's like you said, if you try to focus on too many things, you lose it, you get burned out. But if I also think about the idea, like we're building towards star time, you know, that gives me hope, right? At least put some hope on the windshield.
Yeah, so. Yeah, exactly. And of course, what you're talking about is the journey of the traditional tarot. Yeah. And yes, obviously, if we are following the fool's journey, then the next step after the tower should be the star. Mm-hmm. And our choice is going to be, is it going to be the star upright or the star reversed? Mm-hmm. But either way, the star comes. But I don't have any sort of sense of when that happens, but it's something you can work towards, that we should work towards.
Mm. I love that. It's such an interesting way of kind of looking at the problems. And I've seen, you know, a lot of different kind of approaches, and I like taking a little bit from all of them. So I really appreciate your take on that. I don't want us to get too bogged down and wind up running out of time, but you know, in your books, you're talking a lot about these kind of Appalachian practices, and we've talked a lot about, you know, what it's like being from the South. Do you consider these practices to be closed? Do you feel like they are they accessible to everybody? Can everybody take something from them or learn something from them, which are two different things?
I don't know that we get a choice about a practice being closed or not. I don't. The reason I started writing about all of this is that the culture was shifting from a lot of people coming in from outside and, you know, rural electrification, all that stuff. So I wasn't sure. And I wrote a paper. Let me wave my Harvard flag. I wrote a paper for a colloquium at Harvard called Forging Folklore. And in it, I wondered if I would want to teach this outside of my culture, because there is a thing that we call, and I got this from a friend of mine who's a professional storyteller, called cultural strip mining. Mm-hmm. So people come into Appalachia and they take whatever they like, you know, they take the fiddle music and the quilts and the cornbread, but they continue to look down on the culture and to mock it. It's the reason I don't allow anyone to use the word hillbilly around me. Mm-hmm. Because if you are from this culture, and we can kind of poke each other and go, well, that's some pretty hillbilly shoes you got on there. That's one thing. There are words that within cultures are acceptable that outside of cultures are not. And that is one of those words. So if somebody from Connecticut uses the word hillbilly with me, I know what they mean. I know what the underlayment of that is. Mm-hmm. And it's not good. And it is not respectful. And it is not knowledgeable about the culture. So I don't know whether to tell you it's a closed practice. I know that this particular kind of folk magic, a lot of it works really well for a lot of people. A lot of it is based on the herbs found in this area. And this is one of the most biodiverse areas in the world. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I'm going to say yes and no. I'm going to ride the fence on that one, because yes, some of this stuff works, but I'm going to tell you, any kind of witchcraft, if you are just picking and choosing and playing at it, it's not going to work for you. And then you're going to wonder, well, maybe I need to go, I've played with this, you know, Appalachian folk magic right now is hot, hot, hot. Well, it's not going to be hot forever, because people are going to decide it's too much work or it's too rural or whatever they will decide. And they'll move on to the next thing. We see it all the time. But the point is, if you put down some roots in whatever practice you are doing, then you will have success at it. And if you practice it, because we call it practicing witchcraft for a reason, because you have to practice it. But if you're just going to pick and choose, well, I'm going to do a little bit of Ifa today. Well, I think I'll be a Catholic tomorrow. Well, how about doing a little Appalachian folk magic? Well, how about a little Pennsylvania history? And all of that ends up being a mishmash that is not particularly effective. They might make you happy, like wearing a coat of many colors. There, I've quoted the Dolly Parton song. It might make you happy to feel like, oh, well, I know all about this thing and this practice and this practice. But if you are not practicing the damn practice, you are not going to get anything out of it. Hmm. It is not just a collection of bits and pieces.
There again, off my soapbox.
No, whatever soap you're using, you're using it well because it's got some good soapboxes coming with it.
It's lye soap.
Yeah, it might be a little harsh for my delicate skin, but that's okay. No, that's fine. And it also comes down to this context thing, which we've talked about a little bit here, which is, you know, it's one thing to say like, well, I understand planting by the signs sort of in theory. It's another thing to actually like go outside, see the new moon, think, of, you know, and know you can feel if the soil is wet or not. We can smell whether or not that rain is deep enough to plant, right? You know,
I remember reading somewhere, and I wish I could quote it, that in medieval times in France, the way they would decide whether or not the soil was ready for planting is that the men in the village would all get together and they would drink raw red wine. Then they would run out and dance out into the fields and drop their trousers and sit down on the bare soil. And that way they could tell if it was moist enough and warm enough to plant. And mm-hmm. I just thought that whether that is true or not, it is exactly the way folklore works. That first we're going to have a party about it because this is a big deal. We're going to plant now. Mm-hmm. So first we're going to drink a bunch of wine, tell a bunch of stories, talk about how Jacques got so drunk last year he threw up. And they were going to dance out naked in the fields. And then they probably fell asleep and the women went out and planted. Is what I'm guessing.
Right. Yeah. And it's that deep knowledge, right? Like it comes from, you know, years of experience, years of practice. And that's, I think, true for the magic too, is if you're in the space, it's not that somebody can't, you know, have grown up in Ohio and be in the Appalachians and learn the magic and learn how to work with it. It's going to require a lot of effort, and it's going to require understanding that context more deeply than just picking up a book, right? So.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, that being said, what are some of your favorite tools to work with? What are some things that you sort of look at and go, this feels particularly close to my heart in practice?
Gravel. Mm-hmm. I work with a lot of gravel. And I have in my second book, Asphidity and Madstones, I talk about what gravel really is. Because I'm surrounded by New Age people who can tell you everything about exotic stones. Don't get me started on moldavite. And they'll go, oh, but its characteristics are this or that or this or that. And so what stones do you work with? And I go, well, I work with rocks that have garnet in them. And I work with mica and I work with gravel. And they just look at me like I'm joking. But gravel is something that is mined. You know, it just doesn't appear in your driveway. Mm-hmm. And what that is here, Appalachian gravel, is the heart of ancient mountains. Mm-hmm. And when you think about gravel, humble gravel is that, oh my gosh, then how powerful a piece of heavy stone do you have in your hand? How powerful is that? And if you can connect to that, you are connecting down through the beginnings of the planet. Because these are old mountains. They're some of the oldest mountains in the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard the phrase that they're older than bones.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Well, that was a great article, wasn't it? Mm-hmm.
That was so good.
You don't find those kind of bones here because the mountains formed before that. I used to always say they're the oldest mountains in the world, and then somebody, a geologist friend, said, "Well, they're maybe the oldest mountains above water," mm-hmm. and then another geologist friend said, "Well, we think there are some older mountains that really aren't even mountains anymore in Africa." So now I say they are among the oldest mountains in the world.
Sure. Well, and they're the oldest mountains in North America for sure. You know, no doubt on that. So.
And they connect into the British Isles and in mm-hmm. Northern Europe. So there's that energetic connection.
Yeah. Yeah. It's almost got the feel of, it's sort of the spine of a sleeping dragon. It's been down for a long time, but it's still there, you know.
Ooh, I got a little chill when you said that, Corey. Yeah.
Well, I get chills when I read your stuff. So
I'm going to use that. I'm going to steal it.
Yeah, go for it.
But the thing has been really good for me, especially in traveling up and down the spine of the Appalachians. It is a very long mountain chain, mm-hmm. and so we say here Appalachia, mm-hmm. and we explain it. Well, you can remember it by, if you say it differently, I'm going to throw an apple at you. Appalachia. Well, when I got to, first time I went to Pittsburgh, and I love Pittsburgh, by the way. I love it with a big old chunk of my heart. When I got the first time I got to Pittsburgh, and they met me at the airport, and then they took me to this event, and people were hugging me and going, "We are Appalachian too. We live in Appalachia." And I was like, oh, the hair stood up on the back of my neck. But just as I do not own Appalachian folk magic, I do not own the cultures of the Appalachian Mountains. So they go all the way down into the deep south and all the way into Canada. Mm-hmm. And those are very different connecting cultures all the way up and down.
Mm-hmm. And it's, you're absolutely right. There is, you know, and there's validity to sort of each step of that practice. So, you know, where I'm in Pennsylvania, I'm not far from what I call the Appalachians, you know, but some people kind of over in that area are going to call it Appalachian. And boy, that felt weird saying that.
No, it does. It feels like saying a bad word.
It does. But yeah, there is a sense that, you know, they are absolutely of that place. In many ways more, I mean, in fact, they've lived in those mountains more than I have lived in those mountains. So they have much more right to make that determination for themselves. So it really is interesting. And at the same time, there are all these threads that we see, we can sort of see those connections. Like, you know, we can see, oh, well, they've got a New Year's custom of eating something green, and, you know, maybe putting a coin in the pot with it while it cooks to add a little luck. And I, you know, I can look and see the greens that get cooked, you know, down south, and we eat those on New Year's Day. And it's, you know, cabbage in one place, turnip or collard greens in another place, but there's a thread that connects them. Do you find that that's pretty true for kind of wherever you go in the mountains?
Not only in the mountains, but just folklore in general, because I love to talk to other practitioners of whatever their folkloric magic tradition is. And it's been years ago now, probably 20 years ago, a local Catholic priest who had the Spanish ministry in his church contacted me. And he said he had a parishioner who was from Colombia. And at that point, there were lots of Spanish-speaking workers here, but not so many families, and they had not brought in their curanderas yet. Mm-hmm. So this woman was looking to break a family curse, and she didn't know who to turn to, and so she went to her priest, which is what we do in these cultures. And the priest said, well, I don't know anything about that, but I know somebody who does. So he contacted me, and we got together in a public park, and he sat between us and translated about what she needed and who I was. And she was still not comfortable because I didn't speak her language. I didn't look like her. Mm-hmm. But I started unpacking my little basket, and I took out two hen's eggs, and I took out some red thread, and I took out a sharp knife, and she visibly relaxed. Mm-hmm. Because all of those pieces were pieces she understood. So she knew I could do what she needed done because I had all the accoutrement of that she expected to see. And I have found that again and again in other cultures, especially with eggs. Eggs are ubiquitous. Mm-hmm. And if you are doing work in a culture and you're not sure where to begin, begin with an egg, and you're probably going to be okay.
Yeah, that's good advice. Yeah, I was going to say the eggs and the red thread specifically. As soon as those appear, for me, I'm like, yep, I'm right there with you. So.
Yeah.
That's great. Byron, this has been absolutely delightful getting to chat with you. If people want to know more about you and your work, we're going to put the link to your website in the show notes, and you've got some social media sites. Are there other places they can look for you, or do you have any kind of big plans on the horizon?
Well, I've got books coming up. I'm working on and have finished doing the artwork for a deck of Appalachian themed cards, mm-hmm. Divination cards. And I'm setting in to hopefully get back on the road next year. I'm booked into some interesting festivals. They're going to fly me into North Dakota, which I'm excited about. I've never been there. And my hope and plan and prayer is that I will also get back to Scotland and to Cornwall next year.
Mm-hmm. That'd be
so yeah, nice. So they can get me social media. I'm Byron Ballard on social media, Twitter, Insta, and of course I'm on Facebook like a maniac. And then they can always email me, especially if they are someone in the Appalachian diaspora and they need some advice about something. They can email me at info@myvillagewitch.com and I'll do my best to answer their questions.
That's wonderful. I love that. I love that, again, it's community service, and I love that you do that. It's fantastic.
Well, people need to know. Appalachian people need to know that these weird old practices that they grew up with have value. And they're not satanic.
Also. Right. Yeah. And that they and that they are doorways, or like you said, rabbit holes, to finding out so much more about the culture too. And some of the stuff that they didn't know they were missing. So
good way to put.
Indeed. Well, Byron, again, thank you so much for being with us. This has been absolutely delightful. I feel like, you know, at some point you and I are going to be sitting in the room together, and we're going to be sitting, sipping something hot, and we're going to put our feet up by a fire, and we're going to go on for hours. But
I relish the thought of that. And I thank you today for your hospitality. It's been delightful.
Well, thank you for being with us. Have a great day.
You too.
These old bones will tell your story. These old bones will never lie. These old bones will tell you surely what you can't see with your eye. So goes the chorus of the Dolly Parton song, These Old Bones. Storytelling and knowing things seem to be two very common threads in Appalachian life, and both were with us in our chat with Byron Ballard today. We hope you thought so too. Our immense thanks to Byron for being a part of the show. You can find out more about her and her work at myvillagewitch.com and through the links in our show notes. If you have thoughts on this episode or any other, you can feel free to reach out to us at our email addresses, compassandkey@gmail.com or newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com. You can also visit newworldwitchery.com, where you can find the show notes for this episode, plus over 200 other episodes, and several hundred articles on folk magic, various types and kinds and methods and all sorts of things if you're interested. You can find us in lots of social media. We're pretty active on Instagram, Twitter as well. We're around on Facebook, YouTube, even TikTok if you're really looking for us. You can always support us on Patreon. Patreon provides a lot of the funding for the work that we do, and also gives us some really good opportunities to expand and do other things as well. So if you're interested, feel free to stop by patreon.com/newworldwitchery and drop a dollar a month or whatever you can afford into our witchy hat as well. If you'd like to reach out to us and leave us a voicemail, we do have a voicemail number. That number is 442-999-4824. That is 442-99, which, if you'd like to leave us a voice message, we do love getting those too, if you're interested in doing that. And you can always feel free to check out our sister podcast, Myth Taken, a Buffy the Vampire Slayer podcast. If you are interested in Buffy the Vampire Slayer, it is a fun conversation and a delightful ride that we certainly encourage you to come on over. We look at things from a perspective of people who have degrees in literature, as well as people who have a lot of magical experience under our belt. I oftentimes bring folklore into the mix as well. So if you like those things and want to talk about those in relation to Buffy the Vampire Slayer, that's the place to go. And I think that will about do it for us this time. We do hope to hear from you, and we hope you enjoyed this episode. Again, our immense thanks to Byron Ballard for being with us today. And until next time, thanks for listening. Be well. New World Witchery is a production of New World Witchery Podcasts and is released under a Creative Commons Share and Share Alike license. The title and closing music for this episode is Woman Blues by Paul Afgernos, licensed from AudioSocket.